Good morning. We're going to call the Agriculture and Food Finance and Policy Division meeting to order. And I know, again, we have a full agenda, so thank you, everyone who's here today prompt and in this very cold and blustery weather that we're having. I appreciate that we've got a number of people in the audience, including a number of FFA members. So we have the FFA Ag Policy Experience happening. These students committed to this long before they knew what the weather was going to be like and the fact that they might have the possibility of school, not having school. So we appreciate that you have come and that you are here experiencing ag policy in this committee and that you'll have the opportunity, some of you, to be able to testify later on a bill. So thank you for coming, and hopefully you enjoy the next hour and a half of our meeting. So we are going to do a couple of things today. One is everybody has gotten a budget book. This is our start of talking about the budget and talking about some of the aspects of our budget. We've got the Board of Animal Health today and AURI that are going to be presenting and giving us information. Over the coming weeks, we'll hear more about the funding proposals from the governor's budget and from the Department of Ag's budget. And we will also, so these budget books are kind of ours to keep here on the cart. We'll have them. So if you have a request to get any information from them, please let us know and we can do that. Otherwise, we're going to keep the budget books and then you don't have to haul them back and forth with you and leave them in your office. So just so you're aware of that. But today we're going to get started. The Board of Animal Health is here. They're going to just provide a little bit of a budget and function overview and give us an update on some animal disease issues that have been going on as well. So Dr. Thompson is here, and I'm going to ask her to kind of get you know what, while we're waiting here, I'm going to have Representative Wozniak, have you been able to review the minutes, and would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, I have. I would like to move to adopt the minutes from the January 24th meeting.
Thank you. So a motion has been made to move the January 24th minutes. Any corrections or additions? Seeing none, then all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. So welcome to the committee. Dr. Thompson, we're just going to turn it over to you and let you give us the presentation. So if you'd go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair Poppe. Members of the committee, my name is Beth Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and State Veterinarian. We appreciate this opportunity to come before you today, give you an overview of what the board does here in the state of Minnesota. I also have Morgan Grelson with me. He's the business manager, and he will be testifying later on in the presentation regarding our budget. And welcome, too, to the FFAers. I didn't realize I was going to have a big audience today like this. So the Board of Animal Health was established in 1903. Agriculture has always been important to the state of Minnesota. It's a backbone of what we are and what we do. And I'm kind of a history buff. So I was reading through information that was given to the Historical Society from J.J. Hill back in, I think it was 1897 or thereabouts. I was reading this weekend, and there was a paragraph out of his presentation that hit me. And this is from J.J. Hill. The farmers in Iowa are plagued with hog cholera. We are having more of it in this state than we ought to have. Though I for years believed it would never bother us in this state, I now know that it can be carried, even in the clothes of a man, can be carried by a dog, can be carried by sheep and cattle. I brought a carload of cows from northern Iowa last spring, dairy cattle, took them out to my farm, and within 3 weeks had the first case of hog cholera and lost about 80 little pigs. I quarantined at once, and with the aid of the state veterinarian, Dr. Reynolds, was able to stamp it out. But I would have lost my entire herd of pigs. So throughout history, whether it was hog cholera or glanders or tuberculosis, the state of Minnesota has put the information that we have using the state veterinarian and for tackling these diseases that are out there. We are a board. The governor appoints our five-member board. Working from the left of the screen is our current board president or chair, Dean Compart. He's a hog producer from the southern part of the state. Next to him is Peter Ripka. He's from more of the central part of the state, a dairy farmer. In the middle is our newest board member, Erica Sawatsky. She is a turkey producer from out in the Wilmer area. Next to her is one of our veterinarian members, Dr. Graham Brayshaw. He works with the Golden Valley Humane Society. And then last but of course not least, Dr. Matt Anderson is on the far right-hand side of the screen. Dr. Matt Anderson is a large animal veterinarian down in my area of the state, down near Zimbrota. And he also helps us out because he works with the livestock market down in Zimbrota. So in addition to our board members, we also, by statute, have consultants to the Board of Animal Health. Those consultants include the Commissioners of Agriculture, Health, and the Department of Natural Resources, the Director of the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and also the Dean of the College of Vet Med. In addition to that, the board also utilizes task forces and committees. And right now, a couple of our committees that are very active are the committee that's working on commercial dog and cat breeders, program of excellence. We also have the EDMC, the Emergency Disease Management Committee, which works with our poultry producers. As you all may know, we've had low-path avian influenza in the state this past year. And then in addition to that, we also have a farm survey task force. This is our org chart. We are a small agency. We usually range right around 40 employees. Starting over on the left-hand side of the screen and moving in one box, we have two of our veterinarians that work out at the poultry testing laboratory in Wilmer. That would be Dr. Shauna Voss and Dr. Dale Lauer. And then their employees are listed below them. The folks up there that are listed in green are our field staff. We have 13 field staff. We have one position that's open right now. And they are both veterinarians and non-veterinarians that are located throughout the state. And then the rest of the staff are located here in St. Paul. And this would be a good time to mention, too, we also utilize USDA field staff throughout the state. There's a handful of veterinarians and non-veterinarians on the USDA side that help us out with some of the board programs. The basis of what we do at the board starts out with testing, and the University of Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is the official laboratory for the Board of Animal Health. The VDL, as we call it, is a national leader. It's a full-service diagnostic lab located here in St. Paul. And then in addition to that, the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory, the lab that I've already mentioned, is also part of the VDL. That's a cooperative effort between the University of Minnesota and the Board of Animal Health. And out at the MPTL, they serve as the authorized lab for the National Poultry Improvement Plan for Minnesota, and they administer that plan. It's called the NPIP. Testing out at the Poultry Testing Laboratory includes salmonella, influenza, mycoplasma. And again, it was such a wonderful thing that happened with the monies that came from the legislature and the governor's office back in 2015 and 16, that expansion to that laboratory out in Wilmer, so we can better serve the poultry producers here in the state of Minnesota. What we do is detect, control, and eradicate disease. The board looks to and works with experts to do these tasks. We look to our researchers, both at the University of Minnesota, all of those researchers located here in the state of Minnesota and other states, working to identify current or emerging diseases. We also partner with our other state agencies, and I have a slide and a few more slides that I can show you what we do. In addition to that, but most importantly, is the collaboration that we have with those folks, those boots on the ground. The producers, livestock producers throughout the state of Minnesota, and also all of the veterinarians. When I first started at the board over about 12 years ago now, I think, we were beginning working on import standards. And I think back to if any of you are livestock producers or have moved animals, companion animals, there's a certificate of veterinary inspection that's required when animals move from one state to another. When I started, it was a piece of paper. Now, with technology and with the smart minds that know the technology, we've moved those CVIs into an electronic format. So now producers, small animal, if you're moving your companion animal across state lines, you can use one of those two methods. And in addition to that, we've also used technology for that official identification that's required for animals moving across state lines. So if, for example, I'm going to move a cow from South Dakota down to my farm near Zimbrota, they could wand that RFID tag, that radio frequency tag, get that information and put that on either that piece of paper that's moving with the cow or transmit that electronically. Again, in the last 10, 15 years, huge strides have been made both here in Minnesota but also across the United States for animal movement purposes. So this was a slide that I had mentioned before. Before I talk any more about our emergency planning and preparedness, an example of how we work with other state agencies, that picture that you see up on the left-hand side of the screen, there are three state agencies represented in just the four people that are standing there in that picture. And that picture was taken during the RMAR exercise this past year, and that stands for the Ag Response Management and Resources Exercise that was held in the spring of 2018. This was a national exercise to take a look at what we all would do during a foot and mouth disease outbreak. It was a three-day exercise. There were over 1,700 people involved across the United States coming from 13 different states. And it started out with an introduction of foot and mouth disease, which is a foreign animal disease, being located in a small herd out in Montana. And as we worked through that exercise, more herds were discovered in other states, and it really tested what we do every day in preparation for such a disease. In Minnesota, too, we brought together our livestock commodity groups into that room so that they could see what it is that the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources, all of the different state agencies that were involved in that response. When we talk about emergency response, the one thing that we must acknowledge is that there are really two different parts to that response. There is the response that happens on the infected premises. And usually at that point, you've got a herd or flock that's quarantined. You've got the various regulatory personnel that are coming to that farm. Excuse me. There's the epi investigations that occur. There's all sorts of activity on that farm. But on this slide, we're talking about the secure food supply plans. Those plans are for the people that are not infected but affected. If you go back to 2015, when we had highly pathogenic avian influenza within the state, there were many affected producers located throughout the state. And we looked to, on the bottom of that list for that outbreak, the Secure Poultry Supply Plan. It was that information about the biosecurity on those affected sites, the information that they had about where things were moving, that we were able to go to and allow those people to continue their business. So when a foreign animal disease is diagnosed, either here in Minnesota, in the Midwest, or across the United States, it's imperative for our farmers to be prepared, and that's what these secure food supply plans do. These plans are supported by science, and the board is doing a variety of different tasks related to each one of these plans. Moving on, current events. As I mentioned, we are working with the various livestock groups on the secure food supply plans. I was just out in Pipestone about, I think it was 10 days ago, whenever they got the 10, 12 inches of snow out there. We brought together the state veterinarians from South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and myself to sit down and talk with some producers about the secure food supply plan, specifically the secure pork supply plan. We're doing a lot of that work, and we're also supporting what it is each one of those commodity groups is doing. We're also teaming up with the Department of Health on the longhorn tick. This is something that caught our attention back in 2017. The longhorn tick was identified in New Jersey in a sheep flock. It seems that it's been in the United States probably longer than 2017, but this is not a native tick to United States. It's native to Asia, and also New Zealand and Australia have some problems with this tick. And of course, it's a tick, so it can carry certain diseases. It can affect people. So this next spring, the Board of Animal Health and the Department of Health are going to be working on educational pieces going out to both our producers and to the general public. Third on the list, responding to low-path avian influenza. We did have diagnoses of avian influenza in the state of Minnesota this last October. There is a big difference between high-path avian influenza, which we saw back in 2015, and low-path avian influenza. Low-pathogenic avian influenza generally does not make birds sick. So what we do with those flocks, and there were a total of 9 flocks, what we do with those flocks is continually surveil them, meaning that we test them, and once they've cleared the virus, they can then go on to slaughter. And then the last two bullets on this slide, I'll cover a little bit more in some additional slides, but we're also monitoring African swine fever and then carrying out and making changes, carrying out the audit recommendations on our CERVID program and making programmatic changes. So African swine fever, amongst the diseases that wake me up in the middle of the night and keep me awake, this is one of them. This is a disease that if we were to find it within North America, within the United States, it would be an unbelievably huge detriment to our hog industry. African swine fever only affects hogs. This is a disease that is specific to them, but as you all may know, not in Minnesota, but in other parts of the United States, not only are there commercial herds, but there's also the wild hog population. What we're seeing, and the map that's up in front of you right now, was an outbreak of African swine fever located in China. And this dates back to August of 2018 with the first reported case. But if you look at China on that map now, it's basically spread across the majority of that country. This disease will more than likely cause hogs to die. If not, they get very sick and they need to be depopulated. There is no vaccine. There is no treatment. And it's my understanding that the hog industry in the United States today exports almost 30% of their hogs. And if we were to have this disease, it would be a severe trade limitation for our hog producers. So biosecurity is key for our hog producers, but also, as I mentioned in a couple of slides back, having those secure plans in place and also having the testing available, the understanding of that disease so we can respond. And then on to our farm CERVID program. The Minnesota law that directs board involvement or board oversight of this program went into effect in January of 2004. Farm CERVIDs within the state of Minnesota, we've got a list up there, deer, elk, moose, reindeer, they are considered livestock within the state of Minnesota. The regulations for this program are located in our chapter, Chapter 35. The list up there including registration, annual inspection, response to escape farm CERVIDs or wild CERVIDs that get into a farm CERVID enclosure, fencing, identification, chronic wasting disease surveillance, and importation of farm CERVIDs is all located within that chapter. And then the rules that are associated with that portion of Chapter 35 are listed up there also. If you are interested, we have forms on our website that go into great detail on our farm CERVID program. And they also include guidance, including the registration form, inventory report, fawn and calf inventory reports, inspection guidelines, our laws and rules, and also our farm CERVID handbook.
Dr. Thompson, I'm just going to interrupt you for a moment. I think Representative Eklund has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Dr. Thompson. The farm CERVIDs issue, Do you apply the same import standards to livestock, to the cervids that may come from another state that a farm is importing as what you talked about earlier?
Dr. Thompson.
No, Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, every species has a different import standard. For example, there are increased import regulations for animals moving out of the brucellosis zone out west. With farm cervidae, they need to come from an area, excuse me, that is non-endemic for chronic wasting disease. There is also a permit process that's in place so that before the animals move, they have to be calling for permits, and there is communication between the board here in Minnesota and with the other state where those animals are coming from. And if I might, I also, with that one of the handouts that we gave you, there's information on the middle of the first page regarding the farm cervid imports that have come into the state of Minnesota. The information there is from fiscal year 18, I believe.
All right, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was interesting going through some of the prior livestock diseases. I think when we had bovine tuberculosis and high pathogenic avian influenza, the response was to kill all the animals. Kill all the animals within the fence. But it's clear with chronic wasting disease in the farm cervid industry that we do not kill all the animals in the fence. In fact, we've set up all of this accommodation for the industry where they're not treated the same way as we've treated other livestock. The people of Minnesota have paid $450,000 to monitor around a captive deer farm, $150,000 each year to monitor outside of it because the farmer refused to depopulate when they had a positive deer. So I think the standard needs to be equal, that if there is a contaminated deer, and we know now from testimony last week that chronic wasting disease is transmissible through inanimate objects. So I want everybody to think about what that means. That means the location is a biohazard, and we don't know how long this lasts. So, Madam Chair and members, I think we have to look at some very serious questions here that we don't want to think about. But at a minimum, we need to start thinking about how do we treat farm cervids like we treat other livestock in terms of the response and the responsibilities.
Dr. Thompson, if you have comments about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, members of the committee, excuse me, that is a correct statement that the board does not have regulations requiring the depopulation of a farm cervid herd if it is diagnosed with chronic wasting disease. That is a correct statement.
Right. I don't see any other questions right now, so go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lewitt.
Do we have any other domestic livestock that are treated in a similar manner? In other words, if you do have a positive tuberculosis animal in a livestock herd, how does the federal government and state of Minnesota treat that? Is it automatic? They're all going to be killed?
Dr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee, generally speaking, if we think back to the mid-2000s when we did have bovine tuberculosis within the state, a herd would be quarantined, and then they would be quarantined to slaughter. They would not move to another premises. It may not happen exactly at the same time. They might be fed out, but, yes, they would be moved on to slaughter.
So, Dr. Thompson, is that occasionally we have dairy herds in other parts of the United States. We've been fortunate enough not to have tuberculosis in a dairy herd in Minnesota in quite some time, but we do have dairy herds that are under surveillance out there, or have been. They probably are off now because that's usually a five-year thing, but I would just be a little cautious on the blanket statements that my friend Representative Hansen laid out about how those animal diseases are treated. you know, there's a little bit different approach depending on what type of livestock, particularly for tuberculosis, than kind of the blanket statement that Representative Hansen put forward. And that's my observation of watching this very closely for 20 years and being directly involved.
All right. Dr. Thompson, otherwise you can respond if there's any. I don't know that there's a question, but if you have a comment regarding that. And then otherwise, I think you can continue with the presentation.
All right. Madam Chair, Representative, and just a follow-up comment, that is a very good observation in that the federal government does allow dairy herds, other herds, if they're infected with bovine tuberculosis, to do the test and removal program, which does take a period of time. Minnesota, we didn't take that advantage of that during tuberculosis, but yes, in other parts of the country that has happened. And then the last, and I believe this is the last slide that I have, members of the committee, the mandatory chronic wasting disease surveillance that is done in our farm survey program. 100% surveillance is required by the statute. Samples can be taken by the producer, by the veterinarian. If we have field staff in the area that can help out with that, they can certainly go to that farm and help out with the taking of the sample. And also the producer can submit the whole head to the veterinary diagnostic lab, but that is at an extra cost. We are planning to have additional training for producers, veterinarians coming up this year in 2019. So that we can do some further information, pushing out that how to do that testing, because it is somewhat difficult for some of that testing, because as many of you are aware, when you test for CWD, it's on a dead animal. And not only do lymph nodes need to be taken for this program, but also a part of the brain stem. And with that, unless there are more questions, I believe our business manager would like to.
Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that's the topic of the survey who has been around a while and discussed for a while. And as I understand, the Board of Animal Health has responsibility for the animals inside the fence and DNR for those outside the fence, the wild deer. And it was recommended that the communication lines be improved and more work together with DNR. What's being done in terms of working together with the other agency and trying to get a better handle on this situation?
Dr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, there's a lot of work that has been done. We continue to do in that area. Specifically, we brought together our, I'll call them program managers from the two agencies. They had a number of meetings together, and we've entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Natural Resources, really carrying through on some of what was seen out of the legislative audit. Some of the areas that were covered by those discussions include escapes, the sharing of information from chronic wasting disease testing, and general data sharing between the two agencies. But they continue to work together on those issues.
Okay, Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Thompson, I was reading the OLA's report on the Board of Animal Health yesterday, and one of the recommendations was to increase your board size. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, what your plans are on that, if you foresee a change.
Dr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, and members of the committee, we have not, as an agency, made any movement on changing that board size. We look to our board members for recommendations on that, and, of course, any legislative body that would see fit.
Representative Poston.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we will be proposing removing the Cervidae responsibility from the Department Board of Animal Health and move it back to the Department of Natural Resources.
All right. Well, we'll probably need to discuss that at a different point, but unless anybody has any other further comments about that right now, I think we will continue. And so, Dr. Thompson, now you're turning it over. Is that correct? So
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. Morgan Grelson. I'll have him introduce himself.
Perfect. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Morgan Grelson, and I'm the business manager with the Board of Animal Health. And I'm going to go over a couple slides with some preliminary information on terms of our budget as it currently is in our in the state's budgeting system for fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 21. Like most agencies and organizations, our primary cost driver is our salary and benefit costs. For fiscal year 20, we have about $4.3 million budgeted expenses for our staff and fringe costs, and about $4.4 million budgeted for fiscal year 21. The primary fixed costs that we have are with our IT costs of about $480,000, and our contracted vendor costs. Some of our vendors that we have under contract are the, primarily the University of Minnesota for avian testing services, chronic wasting disease testing, and Seneca A testing. We also have a contract with the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Reserve Corps for leading some emergency preparedness and coordination work that they do. So in terms of our variable costs, it really the variable costs are with staffing and benefits and our contracted vendors. Over the past few years, we've achieved some cost savings in Dr. Thompson mentioned it earlier in her presentation, and that is with some efficiencies in technology. So the movement that Dr. Thompson mentioned with going from a paper certificate of veterinary inspection to an electronic version really helps us to more efficiently and effectively gather data, manage the data, and then use the data more efficiently in terms of driving decisions that that are made in terms of how we go about our work. The another reduction over the past few years has been in our administrative costs, where several years ago we had four assistant directors. We now have two assistant directors. So there's some administrative cost savings that that have been achieved there. Over the past few years, our general appropriations have increased by about 1.25% in fiscal year 17, and then less than 1% increase in our general appropriation for fiscal year 18 and fiscal year 19. At the same time, like all state agencies, the labor costs, our staff and benefits, through the labor agreements and the pay plans have gone up about 2.5% for fiscal year 17, 2% in fiscal year 18, and 2.25% for fiscal year 19. And so what we're seeing, in addition to that, we have reduced funding from the federal government through our USDA funding. And so that's decreased, the USDA funding has decreased about $32,000 over the past several years. So what the overall impact for our agency is, while we're seeing our costs increase, our funding and appropriations haven't quite kept up with the increases in our expenses. Over the past 18 months, in part in order for us to be able to better manage a number of our services, but especially the chronic wasting disease, the Cervidae program, we've added additional staff to improve our oversight of that program. The next slide, so this is the slide that we're looking at now, fiscal year 20. Then fiscal year 21, And I should note there's a typo on the column that lists salaries and fringes. So on the right side, it lists at $4.9 million, and actually in the pie chart itself is the actual amount that we have budgeted. And again, I just want to remind everyone, these are very preliminary budget figures, and when the budget recommendations from the governor come out in February, then we'll be updating these figures here. So I don't know if anybody has any questions regarding our budget or our expenses.
I think I'll ask a question. Just it kind of goes back to the CWD and the emerging response, emerging funds for taking care of things like that. So how much money do you have allotted for that, and has that been spent down? And how did how were things paid for when you did the special hunts and some of that, just to describe that a little bit more?
Yes. So great question, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And the annual fees that we receive from the Farm Survey inspections are modest. We receive about $30,000 to $32,000 a year in the fees that we collect. And in fiscal year 18, we spent roughly, I have to double check the figures, but I believe it was about $600,000 to regulate that program.
And Madam Chair, we can get back to you with more specifics on that,
right,
if needed.
That's fine. Yes, absolutely.
Yes,
go
Madam
ahead.
Chair, committee members. So the majority of the expenses then that we have for our Survey Day program really is coming out of our general appropriation.
Okay. All right. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to either of the testifiers, I guess it's a three-part question, I think. One, do you believe are the laws and rules adequate in the state of Minnesota to address CWD? Is the Board of Animal Health properly equipped to address CWD? And how would the Department of Natural Resources be better equipped to address CWD other than the Board of Animal Health? So it's a three-part question.
Dr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, members of the committee, first of all, are the laws and rules adequate for addressing chronic wasting disease? There are modifications that could be recommended regarding chronic wasting disease that would better fit dealing with that specific disease. When the laws were passed back in 2002, chronic wasting disease wasn't the specter that it is now. So I think there are additional modifications that can be made. Whether or not I'm not prepared to make those statements right now of specifically which parts of the statute should be modified. Second question, is the board properly equipped to deal with the farm survey industry and also the farms in the state of Minnesota, specifically to chronic wasting disease? As we see chronic wasting disease spreading, I looked up the list of states that now currently have chronic wasting disease in the United States this morning, and it is growing at an alarming rate. And for some of the states, and not just farm cervids, but also wild cervids, some of those states that are beginning to look for chronic wasting disease and finding it, we need to step up our game. So there would be opportunities for additional staff, what we can do to go out and better monitor and better understand chronic wasting disease. Specific to the farm survey industry here in Minnesota, there is room for growth there. In addition to that, and I just have to make a plug for this, is that, you know, the testing for chronic wasting disease at this point in time, whether it's in the farm cervidae population or the wild cervidae population, is on a dead animal. And that puts farm cervidae producers at a detriment because that animal has to die before they can find out whether or not their herd has chronic wasting disease. That's not something that the board can handle, but certainly if there's research out there that can be done for better testing methods, that would be so important to the farm cervidae population. And lastly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hamilton, is the Department of Natural Resources better suited to oversee the Farm Survey Program? Again, I would have to better understand what that would look like, whether or not just moving it into another state agency would actually deal with the disease that we're seeing right now. I can tell you the Board of Animal Health, whether we're talking about Farm Survey or Wild Survey, we don't want this disease in our state. So I think we would share that opinion of we need to do something about the current status of chronic wasting disease. Thank
you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Dr. Thompson, thanks for your organization. You do an excellent job on these issues, and they're difficult. Picking up on what Representative Hamilton said, and you commented about the animal has to be dead to test it for the disease of CW. It's my understanding that every animal that is slaughtered, a cervidae animal for consumption, for meat, are they all tested as part of the slaughtering process for these farm cervidae?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, and members of the committee, that is the law that they are to be tested. Whether or not, and not specifically slaughter, but whether or not an animal dies within the fence and for some reason is not seen right away and the sample deteriorates, those aren't tested. There are the occasional farmers who, for whatever reason, don't notice when animals are gone or dead. So even though the law requires 100% testing, that is not what happens. When they do take them to slaughter plants, though, yes, they will take the samples and have them tested.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Just one more quick follow-up. We talked about you have the authority of animals inside the fence, DNR outside the fence. Who monitors to make sure these fences are maintained? We hear that occasionally a tree falls down and a fence goes with it, and they need to be fixed immediately, but who checks up on that, and or is that just up to the farmer to make sure his fences are okay?
Dr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, it is imperative that the farmer be checking the fences. It is up to the farmer to make sure that the fences are intact. We certainly don't have staff to visit 395 herds across the state to make sure those fences are intact. But we do have enforcement ability. That is one of the inspection portions that we do inspect for. And we also look to, again, Department of Natural Resources, if they are in the area, they will communicate back to us if there are problems with the fence.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And last year, Representative Anderson, we proposed that DNR have the same authority to enforce Board of Animal Health regulations, but that made it through a committee but didn't survive one of the omnibus bills. So that would provide for more eyes on the fences if they're out there and could respond maybe quicker because the CO, there's more COs. So I think that's a minimum thing that we could do to help provide for that. My question is on the committee last week. There was testimony from the veterinary college about that semen would be a bodily fluid that could move chronic wasting disease. The prions would survive in semen. So in addition to blood and urine or saliva, so if there's interstate transport of semen, that could potentially transport prions. So has the board looked at any regulations on interstate transfer, sales, movement of either semen or other products that may carry the prions?
And just before you answer that, the committee that you're referencing is the Environment Committee. Environment Policy Committee. So it wasn't heard in this committee, but some other members may serve on the committee. So, but Dr. Thompson.
Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee, that is a very good point. I also heard that testimony, and that certainly would be on the list of things that the board needs to consider based on the research that's being done.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for the presentation this morning. appreciate that you were able to come and do this, and I think that this will be an issue. The CWD issue is one that we are likely to bring up again and have further conversation about. But thank you for your
presentation
today.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
And for members, just so you know that these have three hole punches in them, so you can put them in this budget book. So if you want to take it with you, you can, but then know that it won't be in your book. So if you want to take the time, either now or at the end of the committee meeting today, that you will want to put that in into the division book, the budget book. And next we have the Agriculture Utilization Research Institute, AURI. Shannon Schlecht is here and Dan Skogan. So we're going to have a presentation again, kind of the overview of the function of AURI, the purpose, the history perhaps, and also then a bit of the budget, as that also falls under this committee's jurisdiction. So welcome to the committee, and if you'll just identify yourself and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Dan Skogan, Government Relations Director for AURI, the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. Great to be before the committee again. AURI has a long history with the state legislature. It was some 30 years ago when the state of Minnesota was going through an ag crisis, and we had very similar reaction to the ag crisis, and the legislature in its wisdom created AURI to add value to commodities that are grown in Minnesota. And here to tell that story today, I have with me the Executive Director of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, Shannon Schlecht. We also have with us today a board member who represents agribusiness, and he'll make a brief comment at the end, and we'll stand for questions. But at this time, Madam Chair, I turn it over to Shannon.
Yes, Mr. Schlecht, welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Schlecht. I'm the Executive Director of the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute. And it is a pleasure to be here today to talk about what AURI is doing for the state of Minnesota, for the economy, and for the agricultural industry to advance opportunities for our producers and for agricultural products. I just want to start out that I feel that AURI is a very unique organization. As I've been at AURI for a little over 3 years, I think we are the envy of other states in terms of the investment that's been made in value-added agriculture, creating new demand opportunities, and the resources and the partnership that has existed for nearly 30 years, as Mr. Skogan mentioned. So AURI was formed nearly 30 years ago. Our main focus is really about value-added agriculture. We do very little on the production agriculture side. It's all about creating disappearance, new utilization of commodities and egg products that are produced here within the state of Minnesota. We drive new sales activity for businesses. We look for disappearance and utilization opportunities for producers. We help create jobs, of course, and we look at what are underutilized or ways that we can rethink about our commodities in terms of creating those new opportunities. We provide service to those entities, to our producers, to empower them to think about if they have an idea, how do we go about commercializing that? What are some of the hurdles that exist? What can AURI do? What can we do with our partners and our network to help turn that idea into a commercial reality? We provide a unique set of services to make this all happen. We work mainly to respond to industry needs through our commercialization services program. But we also do a lot of proactive work through our public initiatives to put new information out to the industry and out to our producers around opportunities that we see through our activities, through our conferences, through our literature reviews that we do around how can we look at these commodities and new uses and then create some economic opportunities. So a lot of it is overcoming technical hurdles. When I look at our staff of scientists and business developers that we have, around identifying those hurdles and then looking at what resources that exist within AURI within the state to overcome them. So they can be technical hurdles through analytical work, laboratories, the research that's needed to move from a proof of concept into a scale-up opportunity. It can be through our network to get them connected to the right resources at the right time and with the right people that have the additional expertise to help move those ideas forward. I also want to add in 2018 we did have a small change to some of our services that we offered, and I'll talk about our programs later on in the presentation, but we did switch to a fee-for-service model in 2018, which was a recommendation of the legislative auditor, and that has changed a little bit in terms of how we scope out projects and how we work with businesses in terms of more of a stage gate approach advance them and to rethink about how we meet those objectives. Those are subsidized rates to Minnesota companies. So the smaller you are, the higher the subsidy is to provide those resources to help moving that opportunity and that idea forward. We've had a long relationship with the legislature, as Dan mentioned, nearly 30 years ago that we were created during the farm crisis, originally created as part of the Greater Minnesota Corporation, and then spun off a couple years later into a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And we continue to have a lot of interaction with the legislature. We submit a report on our activities every year to the legislature, and we also have members of the legislature that serve on our board of directors. And as we look at our current board of directors, we welcome Chair Poppy to the board here starting this with this term. And we also thank Representative Keel for her past 4 years of service and Representative Hamilton as well for her past service to the board of AERI. We have a prescribed board per statute representing agricultural interests from across the state. Those are three commodity organizations that currently include soybean, wheat, and beef, two general farm organizations that are Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, two agribusiness representatives that are currently Cargill and are Larry Johnson, who you'll hear from later, who is very active in the ethanol industry. And then 2 years ago, the legislature gave us permission to add two at-large members. And we are just starting that process. We have an at-large member elect that will be hopefully accepting the position relatively shortly. And then we'll add an additional at-large member next year in 2020. So we'll eventually have an 11-member board at AERI that directs our programs, provides oversight to the organization to create the greatest impact possible for Minnesota. We are mainly a greater Minnesota footprint as well as an organization. Our offices are in Crookston, where we have office space, and we have a laboratory bench space at the University of Minnesota Crookston that we rent and utilize for our microbiological work. We have an office and laboratory footprint in Marshall with Southwest Minnesota State University, where we do a lot of our food work, our analytical testing, and we have a wet lab there for renewable fuels to advance those opportunities and ideas as well. And then we have a pilot facility in Waseca that is mainly focused on densification, dewatering, and looking at egg processing streams in terms of new uses, as well as an office there as well for staff. And then we do have several virtual staff located across the state as well to provide service to every corner of the state where ideas may come from so that we can work with them hand in hand to advance those opportunities. We've structured our work under four focus areas to look at what are new market opportunities or overlooked opportunities that we think we can drive that are beneficial and where we have a core competency here in Minnesota. Those are in bio-based products and renewable energy, where we are looking at how can we use the crops that are growing here to replace petroleum ingredients into different products. We have co-products where we're looking at residual streams or waste streams in terms of repurposing them into a feed, a fuel, or a fertilizer application to add value to that processing stream and to that producer that may have waste streams such as poultry operations or swine operations where we can repurpose that manure stream. Then we have food, which Minnesota is very well known as a food center and a food hub, and we see a lot of activity in terms of new food product development and unique food products that we can help develop as well. And we keep busy at AERI. Last year, we opened 128 projects as an organization. We have a staff of 30, so we are managing a lot of different activities and projects across the state. Roughly a half to two-thirds of those are under our commercialization services program, where we are working with businesses and producers on a more confidential basis to advance our idea. The other ones are through our networking programs, where we're convening and pulling people together around opportunities. And then our public initiatives, where we are actually driving what we call our opportunities and trying to get that out into the industry so that they can take it and then hopefully create a private business opportunity to advance that idea. And then you can see in our map that we do service almost the entire state. Over the last 7 years, we have reached almost every corner in terms of projects that we're undertaking. These are just with our clients that we have, where we're working to advance an opportunity or an idea that they have brought to us, have been referred to us, where we're trying to then put that idea into the commercial marketplace. And we are driven by outcomes and impacts at ARI. Being very close to the businesses that we're working with, we're always looking at how can we, again, create utilization, create opportunities, create jobs. This last year, we had the University of Minnesota Extension do a analysis for us in terms of the impact that we're having across the state. Over the last 6 years of data that we provided them on our commercialization services program, they found a $310 million impact that ARI had on the state economy. That includes, of course, the agricultural industry, the service industry, and the construction industry with capital investments that businesses attributed to the services we provided that are having an impact on those local communities. We are also helping create jobs, over 600 jobs that were attributed to work that ARI did for these clients and businesses. And each year, roughly $142 million in economic activity. That's each year that we're helping provide through new business creation, new ideas that have come to the marketplace. So when we look at that as a return on investment for the $3.7 million that the state provides us, that's around a 40-to-1 return in the dollars that are invested into ARI. And just a quick look at our financial statement for the past year. This is an audited financial statement. We had revenues of about $4.4 million last year, expenses of just nearly $4.6 million. So we did have a deficit spend last year. We've had a lot of activity coming at us, and we needed to dip into reserves as well to service those clients. We've been having wait lists for a period of the last couple of years, and we finally turned the corner on that with the addition of some new staff and some new processes in place as well. I'll speak quickly to some of our program areas where we are working to drive impact. They are mainly in five areas that we categorize them in. Those are public initiatives, commercialization services, the Ag Innovation Partnership Program, our Entrepreneur and Residence Program, and then our Innovation Networking Program. And I'll give a few examples of what we're doing in each of those areas to drive outcomes and impacts for the state and for the agricultural industry. First of all, our commercialization services program, just an example here of Smoothies brand out of Pierce, Minnesota. They have been in, came to us early on, maybe 10 years ago, to look at how can we create a new opportunity for sunflowers. And they had an idea. They needed a feed product. We helped them with the sunflower oil processing and to help them with nutritional analysis, some labeling analysis. And they've since just continued to expand and have gone to a product extension now of microwave popcorn using sunflower oil and continue just to see new opportunities with the trends that they see, the local food, the clean label, and we've helped them through a lot of that process to put new products on the marketplace. They were our Ag Innovator of the Year this year as well, and we're honored to recognize them for the work that they've done and the jobs they've created and the new demand opportunities they've created for sunflower producers. Now, we also do public initiatives. The example here is a plant protein report that we worked on with the University of Minnesota. We were seeing a lot of requests from entrepreneurs around ingredient use for plant proteins. A lot of food entrepreneurs don't have a food science background and they need more basic information. So we worked with the U of M to prepare a basic report around different ingredient options, ingredient formulations, substitutes that they could look at using with plant proteins and crops that are grown here in Minnesota into their food products. Our innovation networking program is all about convening events and opportunities to get the word out about new ideas and possibilities. Last year, we hosted our second New Uses Forum. This is a convening platform to pull together the food and agricultural innovation ecosystem to talk about what's happening and to get people connected with their ideas to the correct resources. We had nearly 200 people at last year's event, which was great to see the outpouring of people from all sides of the state to come and learn about what's happening on the value-added and innovation front. This next year, we are partnering with Compeer Financial and Georgetown's Rural Opportunity Initiative. Word has gotten out that it's been a positive event, and I think we'll grow it this year to an even larger number with new opportunities and additional private equity investors coming to look at what are investment opportunities within the Minnesota food and agricultural ecosystem as well. Another event we did was the Food and Health Nexus, and as we look at Minnesota with its rich history in food and its rich history in medicine, why not tie those two together? So we hosted our first event last fall on around You Are What You Eat, looking at different products that can be created that have health attributes or disease management. And we had over 100 people at this first event that came together to learn about what are the possibilities, what's happening, how do we get connected to the resources to help move some of those ideas forward. Step One Foods, based here in Minnesota, is a great example where they've created a product to replace statin drugs through dietary changes with the products that they've created and have gone through the clinical research and everything to market that product. So some really innovative things that are happening here that we're trying to foster and help advance. A couple other public initiatives underway that we have are our bio-based road sealant that we've talked with the committee about before. This is a long-term project for us in terms of doing some due diligence and collecting data around how it works and the performance. We're partnering with Minnesota Soybean, with Bargain Incorporated, and with a producer down in Missouri as well that's utilizing Minnesota quantities actually in his production. We did receive a national grant from the United Soybean Board this past year to expand that project to Plymouth to look at trails as well as to Montevideo. So that we collect some additional data sites to see how this product is performing over the longer term. And it's mainly soybean-based and then roughly 90% bio-based to extend the life of roads here in the state and then in other regions as well. Our industry thought leaders is a convening of pulling together the rich expertise that exists here to partner entrepreneurs and corporates and having themed discussions around opportunities. The Renewable Energy Roundtable is an annual event as well where we look at what are, again, opportunities around biomass and our corn, soybean, oil history we have here in terms of new ideas, new innovations that may make those projects more efficient. High oleic oil demonstrations, we're partnering with universities here to do cooking demonstrations to see how high oleic soybean oil and high oleic sunflower oil and other crops can perform. The Forever Green Initiative is a partnership with the University of Minnesota through their cover crop and relay crop program where we're part of that project to look at the value-added opportunities of some of those crops that they're moving forward through their system. The hemp value chain, I think we've all heard a lot about hemp here over the last several years, and we are working on a processing guide that we hope to have available by March, April, that will provide some guidance to those entities that are looking at investing in hemp processing and just what are opportunity areas and things that we need to be thinking about that we can learn from Canada and other states that are moving forward. And then we'd have Food Safety Process Authority that is a need for food entrepreneurs. And we did a value-added meats product as product form as well. Since there's been a lot of focus on plant proteins, we also, of course, have a very rich history in traditional proteins and what are ways that we can look at new innovations there. Additionally, our entrepreneur-in-residence program, where we open up our laboratories to entrepreneurs that do not have the resources to rent a lab or to buy equipment, we open up our space to them so that they can, again, work on that idea on proof of concept. That is usually a burdensome cost to them, so they have access to not only our staff but also our resources that exist in our laboratories. And then we started our Ag Innovation Partnership Program a couple of years ago, where each spring we identify a handful of areas that we see opportunities in and then look for proposals from partners across the state to cost share and moving those public ideas forward. We've seen a nice response to that program as well. This year we have a food packaging guide that we're moving forward as well as a local food ingredient sourcing project under AIP that are in process. Last year we did a school lunch program looking at what are some of the constraints of utilizing more Minnesota value-added food products into school lunches? And that was a nice collaboration and partnership as well with a new audience that we don't typically interact with, but we're able to do so through this partnership and then get that information out to food manufacturers. Briefly on our legislative update, we are very thankful for the bonding dollars that were awarded to ARI a couple of years ago. We are using those funds to create a new sensory lab in Marshall, Minnesota, in conjunction with the Culinology Department at Southwest Minnesota State University. We see that as a resource and a need for our food entrepreneurs to provide more objective feedback to their product development, that they can have easier access to that type of a resource. And then in Waseca, we have been running at a very high capacity in Waseca, and we just needed more space. We were having to move equipment in and out of our pilot lab just because we were had outgrown our footprint in 25 years. So we are looking at additional space in Waseca to better meet the needs of our clients that we see in co-products as well. And then finally, the legislative audit report on our programs that was done in 2016, I'm happy to announce that of the 9 recommendations that were made, we have either partially or fully implemented all of those recommendations within up to 2019 here. So we've made good progress in putting those into place, and I think they have helped make us a better organization as well in terms of efficiency and process. And we can't do this alone. At ARI, we are one part of a large innovation ecosystem that is Minnesota is blessed with. We work closely with a lot of organizations from the promotion councils and the producer groups to the university and universities to the Department of Agriculture and through several of the other organizations that exist here that are all trying to advance opportunities and put Minnesota more on the map as an innovation center for food and agriculture. And it's been a great partnership with these organizations and most importantly with the legislature through the foresight that you've had over the years to advance food and agricultural value-added opportunities. So with that, there's more that can be learned at ARI through our website, through discussions. We will have an annual legislative report that will be coming to you shortly that will provide more information on some of our activities and some of our client examples and initiative examples that you can look at. And, of course, we'll be happy to respond to any questions there as well. And I'll turn it over to Larry Johnson. Now, Larry joined our board a couple of years ago, Madam Chair, and just to say a couple of brief remarks, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Representative Poston, do you want to wait, or would you like to take your question now? Okay. We'll go to Larry.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Larry Johnson. I spent 25 years farming in Carver County, cash grain and a turkey laying hen business. After that, I spent about 30 years now in the ethanol business, actually beginning on a contract as a consultant to the Department of Agriculture in Minnesota for about 10 years, developing the ethanol industry here. And the Minnesota, of course, really had led the country in development of the industry as we know it today. And we've got 25 ethanol plants here out of about 210 nationwide. I've been on the AURI board now for 2 years. This is my third year. And I remember when it began, I was still farming at that time, representing corn down here. And I remember when Perpich created this, along with some other supporters for, I think it was well ahead of its time looking back at it now. We had limited opportunity to add value back in those days. But today it has become so different. Having worked in the ethanol industry for a long time, that began as just making ethanol and feed products out of corn. Now we've got the technology, biotechnology, new products that are making proteins and oils and plastics and nutraceuticals and new health foods all out of our raw agricultural products. And it really creates more of a need now for AURI and their expertise to help all these entrepreneurs. A lot of this new technology is expensive, and it's very difficult to get at. So it's a very valuable service today for a lot of the exciting new things that are happening in agriculture and value added. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schlecht, I hope I'm saying that right.
Very good.
You went over your financial statement for 2018, and you mentioned that you had to dip into your reserves. Mm-hmm. What is your statutory requirement for reserves, and what does your reserve balance look like today?
Mr. Schleck.
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, so we have a policy as ARI, as an organization, on our reserves policy. We have a policy of 9 to 12 months for our reserves of our operating budget, which when we look at our biennium funding is a ratio of roughly 0.4 to 0.5, and our reserves balance today is around $4.3 million.
Representative Potion.
Thank you.
And just to follow up on that one, too, you did have to dip into your reserves in 2018. Was that a one-time situation? What's the status kind of the balance sheet at this point, Mr. Schleck?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have looked at reserve spending the last couple of years as an organization. We are working hard to grow our funding through additional opportunities. We've switched to our fee-for-service model. We are exploring additional federal opportunities as well and other grant and donation possibilities. So we're working hard to grow revenues in other areas, but we do continue to see a lot of demand coming at us, and I expect our work and our budget needs will continue to be around this $4.5 to $5 million mark into the at least the next few years.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question too is on the financials and the part in there for the fee for service. Now, you mentioned you had a busy year. And we've talked in the past about doing some work for out-of-state companies. So first question is that $148,000 collected from Minnesota companies or also some from out-of-state folks?
Mr. Schleck.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, our fee-for-service is mainly for services that we're providing to Minnesota clients currently. We've been very busy within Minnesota, and we've taken a very slow approach to our regional expansion efforts because Minnesota comes first in terms of providing our services and opportunities to businesses and clients here. So now our fee-for-service, it ranges in terms of how the programs or grants might be structured. So for example, for Minnesota Soybean, some of our work for them is under a fee-for-service instead of a grant basis, just in terms of how we structured it and are reimbursed for funding.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. So is all of this from in-state, or have you done some work in the past year for out-of-state companies?
Mr. Schlett.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, members of the committee, we've done small amounts of work for out-of-state, but very, very minimal in terms of what those number of projects would be. It'd be less than five that we've done out-of-state currently.
All right. Representative Cleavon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is this. So when you're looking at the fee-for-service model that you currently have you thought about how you would take, instead of charging more fee-for-service when companies are new, but taking the fee for the value added once they become stronger? Thank you.
Mr. Schleck.
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, we are exploring many options. We are allowed by statute to look at licensing and royalty as opportunities, and those are discussions that we are having with some clients that we think would be open to that type of an approach. I did sign one royalty sharing agreement last year, actually, and it's just finding, I think, the right clients that so we can win with the winners, I think, as your point is. Currently, our beginning entrepreneurs, we subsidize 80% of the cost. So it is we try to keep it very manageable to get them over those first hurdles and moving forward towards commercial sales.
Thank you.
I think that's a good motto, win with the winners. So we'll all work on that. Any other questions? Thank you very much for the presentation and the information. And once again, we do have three-hole punch, so you can put that in the budget book, but thanks so much for being here today and traveling out in this weather to be able to be here. So we appreciate that.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will now be talking about our bill that we have, House File Number 221. And I'm just going to ask that Ms. Oswald, if you'll just come to the testimony table and bring your students with you.
I'm going to move House File 221 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. And I'm just going to stay here because you are really the presenters of this bill. So we want to make sure we have a number of, it's a bipartisan bill. This is one that's been carried last year as well. And we know that the Transportation Committee will want to hear more about it and weigh in on this. But we are excited that you came today and that you're able to present. So Ms. Arsvold, I'll just turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chairman Poppe and committee members. I'm Val Arsvold, the Executive Director of the Minnesota FFA Foundation. And in just a moment, I'll let these two talented individuals tell you just a little bit about themselves. But first off, I want to thank you for this opportunity and thank you for bringing forward a really unique and wonderful opportunity to provide support to FFA and 4-H programs across the state of Minnesota through a specialized agricultural license plate bill. The two students that are with me tonight are key, or today are key in sharing the impact that youth organizations have on our future leaders here in the state in agriculture and our local communities. So with that, they have just completed their third and final day, and you'll see all of them have to exit here shortly. They've been involved with the Ag Policy Experience Conference, a wonderful opportunity to see all of you at work and envision themselves in these types of roles in the future. So with that, Nicole and Jeremy, will you introduce yourselves?
Thank you. Yes, go ahead and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nicole Kozalik, and I am a high schooler at the. I'm a proud member of the Randolph FFA chapter. In my very first agriculture class, my ag teacher and FFA advisor, Mr. Terry, asked us, "What does FFA stand for?" Of course, we responded with Future Farmers of America and the National FFA Organization. Very quickly, we learned FFA stands for opportunity, and opportunity is what FFA has given me. While my family lives in town, both of my parents have careers in the ag industry. Most nights at the dinner table, we would talk about agriculture, and I never found the conversation that interesting. Once I started taking classes in agriculture and joined FFA, everything changed for me. I developed a passion for all things agriculture and understood why my parents' dedication to the industry. Since joining as a ninth grader, FFA has given me a career path. I plan to go to college and major in ag communications and agronomy. FFA has helped me find a voice through the Prepared Public Speaking Contest, which I was fortunate enough to advance to the national level. I've been to many leadership camps and conferences and volunteer with my chapter on many community projects. I love meeting FFA members from across the nation. Mr. Terry was right. FFA really does stand for opportunity, not only for me, but all FFA members.
Thank you, Ms. Kozalek. That's a wonderful presentation. All right, next. Introduce yourself and welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeremy Salania. I am a senior at the Cannon Falls FFA chapter. I would like to first kind of state a question that I get a lot, especially whether it's from friends, family, adults, or whoever it may be in my day-to-day life, but I get asked a lot why FFA makes an impact on me, to which I usually get a bright smile and eagerness and readiness to answer that question. Usually I answer that question with saying, oh, well, it's the love and the kindness and the sense of passion and pride that you get in a youth organization that comes with you, not only to where you are in the home and the school, but also outside of that in agriculture and your future. But also, lately I've been thinking of something that reaches far beyond that. FFA, as I get older and am now a senior looking at colleges, it has given me an opportunity to look at my career pathway. FFA has given me the choice, whether it was at Apex this week or whether it was at Intense a few years ago, to tour colleges and different career pathways. I have been able to ramp up and get ready for the college that I would like to attend, and within 48 hours I will actually know whether I've been accepted into my dream college or whether I will have to go to my backup where I can study a career in agricultural communications and marketing and agronomy or plant science. So FFA has given me a pathway that has led me to somewhere that most of my peers that have not experienced the organization are at. A lot of times I see the daily struggle of asking my friends, you know, what they want to do. It's kind of a tough subject. I ask them where they would like to go to college, and a lot of them reply with they don't know or they don't know what they would like to study. So for that, I am truly thankful that the FFA organization has helped me, such with camps and conferences like APEX and Intense, that have helped me decide what I would like to go into and pursue a career in. For that, I'm thankful for the FFA and would like to thank you guys for lending your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Soini. This is, you know, it's always wonderful to see the Blue Jackets in these halls, and it's always wonderful to listen to the students that come forward because you have such great poise and you're articulate and you understand the issues and so impressive. So thank you very much. You did a wonderful job. Appreciate that. Are there any questions for the testifiers?
Chair Poppy, I would share just as committee members, that's all right. I would like to just share a little bit more about the scope of FFA and 4-H in Minnesota, if I could, and just really what the impact will be on these young people's opportunities. So there are over 22,000 students in agricultural education classes, grades 9 through 12 in Minnesota. 11,000 of them are in the FFA and don the Blue Jacket. And I'm assuming and know, actually, that there are some past FFA and 4-H members here in the room, so excited about that. And while they're in our agricultural education classes, they are busy studying agricultural business, animal systems, biotechnology, food products and processing, natural resources and environmental sciences, plant systems, power structures, and technical systems, all valid areas to study and improve the Minnesota economy. But at the same time, while Minnesota FFA is doing things to develop young leaders to be active in their communities as well as prepare for their careers, Minnesota 4-H is doing great things as well. They're based in every county in Minnesota, and they have over 16,000 students who are actively involved with agricultural programs. So their membership is larger, but as we look at the agricultural projects, those are around livestock, veterinary science, and the science of agricultural programs. So the question that has come up is, why an agricultural license plate? And the answer is quite simple. It's an opportunity to celebrate what's right with agriculture and invest in our future, a voluntary way to have Minnesotans show their support. In 2016, over 665,000 people voluntarily paid an additional fee to support a cause that they believe in. These young people are worth that involvement. So as Jeremy and Nicole so nicely said, success comes to these students who are guided with the help of mentors and others, and we ask for this support. The bill has the support and endorsement of numerous organizations, including the Minnesota Farm Bureau, Minnesota Farmers Union, Cooperative Network, Minnesota Pork Producers, Compeer Financial, Ag Country Farm Credit Services, and the list goes on and on. So we ask for your support in moving this forward, as we would like to invest in agriculture's bright future. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Arsvold. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Arsvold, you touched on it, but I'd like to hear from both of the students on why we should support House File 221, the bill that will be before us.
All right. Thank you. So, Jeremy, do you want to go first?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I would love to answer that question. So I believe that this is a cause that is very worth supporting because it not only helps FFA members, but it also helps 4-H members be able to further grow and explore their passions within agriculture. But it also is a great way of donating and being able to help such great youth organizations. And there, like Ms. Arsvold said, there are so many license plates that so many people are willing and able to volunteer to pay an extra fee for, that it is an amazing way to support such a well-renowned youth organization, and it is just an amazing way to be able to help youth like ourselves be able to go on experiences like APEX or on Intense or just be able to function within our FFA careers. So I definitely would support it.
Thank you, Mr. Soini. Ms. Kozlak?
Yeah, Jeremy touched on a lot of the points that I was going to touch on, so just creating the future leaders that we are and continuing to support us so that we can go to the camps and become true leaders.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton.
You know, Madam Chair, you touched on it. We've said this before. It does not matter if the students are black, brown, or white, male or female, urban or rural. When the students from the FFA program come before this committee, they are the best and the brightest that the state has to offer. So thank all of you for being here.
Absolutely. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. We have some time here. Just was going to ask the young lady from Randolph. Got to meet your chapter advisor back when we did the work with the Tracker Rollover Protection Program. And I think your chapter was one of the first to get a rollover installed on your tractor down there for your FFA chapter. How's that old tractor doing? Do you still use it?
Yeah, we still use it. We actually have a little over 10 tractors at this point, and we restore them, and that's what we're just starting now. So we've got a lot of tractors that we use on our FFA plots as well.
Representative Anderson.
But they all have rollover bars on them.
Most of them.
All right. Thank you. This bill is on a path to go to transportation next. What it does do is require an additional fee so that if you purchase the plates, you're going to also contribute to the Minnesota Ag account. A design would need to be created through the Commission of Agriculture. Then those plates would be able to be used, and the contributions would be made, as was indicated, to the FFA and to 4-H. So that's what the bill is. Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify in support or opposition to this wonderful bill? All right. Well, thank you again very much. And I'm going to renew my motion that House File 221 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? The motion prevails, and House File 221 is referred back to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you. Thank you again for attending. Thank you to all of the FFA members. Enjoy your trip home. Hopefully safe travels to all. This was a good hearing, and I understand, you know, we do have weather that's going to get colder and colder as the day goes on, but we do meet again on Thursday, this committee does. So hopefully you, if you have to travel, you travel safely, and we appreciate everyone's attendance today. So with all of that, meeting adjourned.